Not long ago, I did an extended interview on the Old Mole with Ron Verjou, author of Smelter Wars, about the struggle to organize and maintain a union along the Columbia River in British Columbia. That conversation raised issues important to this regular feature that we call Another World is Possible. Issues like, what is the potential role of unions in social change? And within unions, what can be accomplished by activists with a radical vision elected to leadership? With the upsurge in labor organizing these past few years, these questions are not only topical, they are crucial. They're also generally neglected in the scaled-down, timid, defensive political atmosphere of the present, in which any sign of progress appears magnified in importance. Today I'd like to look at another recent book that explores some of the same issues, sometimes in greater depth, because more alert to the questions of activism. Tony Gilpin's The Long Deep Grudge, a story of big capital, radical labor, and class war in the American heartland. Gilpin, it's worth mentioning, is the daughter of one of the radical union officials she writes about. She's also co-author of a different book, an excellent account of organizing among the clerical staff at Yale University. Today's book, The Long Deep Grudge, is about a little-known union, the United Farm Equipment Workers of America, FE for short. Its Communist Party leadership, until it was absorbed by a much larger United Automobile Workers, and its battle against the McCormick family dynasty and their International Harvester Corporation. It's a battle between the U.S. corporation that more than any other pioneered tactics to prevent unions and repress and co-opt them once they formed, and a union whose motto was, management has no right to exist. A battle, in other words, between a company that used goons, court injunctions, fake worker participatory schemes, and so-called unions that the company created and controlled, and on the other hand, a militant union that thought of itself as part of a larger struggle to end capitalism. It's also a battle embedded in long ago and continuing history, a history the union made sure resonated with its members. Many of our listeners undoubtedly know something of the history of May Day, that it stemmed from the struggle in the 1880s for an 8-hour working day, and that an episode in that struggle was the Haymarket Massacre in Chicago, and the subsequent framing and death sentences for leading activists of that time. But do you remember also that the target of that protest at Haymarket and of the demand for an 8-hour day was very specifically the McCormick Machine Harvesting Company, the world's largest farm equipment manufacturer? When Gilpin titles her book, The Long Deep Grudge, she's not kidding about that long, rancorous history and that deep memory. Here's what Nelson Algren had to say in Chicago, City on the Make, in 1951.
City of the Big Shoulders was how the white-haired poet put it. Maybe meaning that the shoulders had to get that wide because there were so many bone-deep grudges to settle. The big, dark grudge cast by the four standing in white muslin robes, hands cuffed behind, at the gallows head, for the hope of the 8-hour day. The grudge between Grover Cleveland and John Peter Altgeld, the long, deep grudges born for McCormick the Reaper, for Pullman and Pullman's Gary. Grudges like heavy hangovers from men and women whose fathers were not yet born when the bomb was thrown, the court was rigged, and the deed was done. And maybe it's a poet's town for the same reason that it's a working stiff's town. both poet and working stiff being boys out to get even for funny cards dealt by an overpaid houseman long years ago, where undried blood on the pavement and undried blood on the field yet remembers Haymarket and Memorial Day.
The white-haired poet he refers to was Carl Sandburg. John Peter Altgeld was the later governor of Illinois who saw how the Haymarket martyrs had been railroaded and pardoned the three of them who hadn't been already hanged. McCormick the Reaper is a great pun. McCormick Works both manufactured harvesting reapers, and safety precautions there were appalling as people died, conjuring up death as the Grim Reaper. When Algren mentions Pullman, he's referencing the 1894 strike in which President Grover Cleveland sent the army into Chicago and dozens were killed. Memorial Day refers to the 1937 police massacre of striking workers at Republic Steel, a place where I worked just 20-some years later. FE, the Farm Equipment Workers Union, was an anti-capitalist union that drew heavily on that history, that held commemorative events annually to keep the history present in the minds of its workers. But what does it mean to proclaim management has no right to exist? If you're a leader of that union, how do you work with its members? How do you teach? How do you continue organizing them? How do you deal with conflicts among workers as you try to promote interracial solidarity, for instance, in conflicts over layoffs in a workplace, which used to hire only white workers? And so white workers have seniority, and thus all the people being laid off are more recent hires and black. How do you do those things beyond encouraging members to identify with a bitter history? These are the real challenges and dilemmas. If you're in a union now and wanting to work toward fundamental social change, what are the implications for how you relate to your fellow workers? How we draw on history, of course, is very much subject to our needs in the present. The Haymarket martyrs were not interested in collective bargaining. Some of them saw negotiating with management as inherently co-optive, as already giving in to a capitalism they aimed to transcend. F.E., on the other hand, did bargain with management, despite challenging management's legitimacy, feeling that a contract offered some protection to its members. But they used the contracts as ongoing ways to mobilize their members, to train them in struggle. Unlike most other union contracts, theirs were generally for 1 year only. As soon as they were signed, the union began involving its members in planning for next year's demands. Their contracts contained no management rights clauses, as nearly all others do. Clauses reserving everything not otherwise specified in the contract to management's discretion. Clauses empowering management to make all decisions about production and investment, from the speed at which people are forced to work to where in the country or in the world the corporation will move or outsource its jobs. F.E. insisted on having a say on all those issues. And their contracts had no grievance procedures, elaborate bureaucratic means of trying to enforce the contract, procedures that often require lawyers and may take months or years to resolve, with grievances that accumulate and then may be traded away as part of contract bargaining. Instead, when the union had a grievance, the workers simply slowed down their work or walked out. Given management's antipathy toward the union, constantly testing it, constantly trying to wring more work, more profit out of its members, there were a lot of grievances, a lot of walkouts. And unlike nearly all other union contracts, those that FE agreed to did not have clauses that barred strikes while the contract was in force. Their focus then was on worker control in the workplace. While other unions were centralizing and bureaucratizing, concentrating on wages and benefits while leaving control in the workplace to management, FE kept their focus on working conditions and on developing the understanding and capabilities of its rank and file. I wish Gilpin's book had gone into more detail about how they did this. But some things are clear. The FE workers loved their union, loved the militancy and activism it enabled. When the UAW, the automobile workers, repeatedly tried to raid them, tried to persuade FE workers to switch unions, they were overwhelmingly rejected for years. Walter Reuther, head of the UAW, believed that workers were willing to sacrifice work conditions for higher wages, weren't interested in struggle, only in consumption. The workers in FE repeatedly showed he was wrong. Their story shows something else. The kinds of unions that came to predominate in the United States after World War II played a role in deactivating, tamping down worker militancy. There's a lesson there for the present as we aim to rebuild the labor movement. And there's a further lesson in the FE story, a caution that militancy isn't enough. In the absence of a larger workers' movement, a larger radical political movement, capitalism proved too strong. After decades of struggle, International Harvester Corporation was able to close and move some of its factories and simultaneously encourage the UAW, a union that did accept the legitimacy of capitalism and management prerogatives, encouraged the UAW to raid and take over FE's workers. I mentioned that the leadership of FE were members of the Communist Party. Gilpin shows persuasively that they kept their independence from party dictates, acting on behalf of what they thought were the best interests of the union, even when that conflicted with the party's policies. That didn't prevent them, of course, from being red-baited by management and its hirelings in the press. Want an example? I'll close with an anecdote she tells. FE union meetings and other union gatherings often ended with everyone singing Solidarity Forever, just like union events often do now. You know the song. When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run. As part of their campaign to tar the FE with the communist label, newspapers would report instead that workers rose to their feet singing the International, a somewhat different song, not to be confused with what they actually sang, Solidarity Forever. I've been talking about Tony Gilpin's book, The Long Deep Grudge, a story of big capital, radical labor, and class war in the American heartland. There are areas where I wish the book had gone deeper, but it's an exciting book that reads like a novel and has both inspiration and lessons for those of us working toward a better world. This has been Norm Diamond for Another World is Possible.